With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, we're in pursuit of Velázquez with the art critic Laura Cumming and her book, The Vanishing Man. Laura Cumming has been the art critic of The Observer since 1999. Previously, she was arts editor of The New Statesman, presenter of Night Waves on BBC Radio 3, and arts producer at the BBC World Service. Her previous book, A Face to the World on Self-Portraits, received widespread critical acclaim. And Laura's latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is The Vanishing Man. And I won't say what the subtitle is, because there's a discussion in this book, Laura, about how one pronounces the name of the artist that this book is about. So let's start with that. How do you?
Yes, there is. And it's rather crucial. I've said in the book that this greatest of painters, the Spanish artist Velázquez, etc., is not a name on everyone's lips in this country. And I actually think that this is partly to do with the pronunciation. I'm not being flippant here. When this book is very largely set in the 19th century, it tells the story of a bookseller in the 19th century. And if you look at the spellings of Velázquez, whose work is only just beginning to percolate through from Spain out into the rest of Europe at that time, I think I find something like 10 different spellings of his name. He's Velasco, Velasqui, Velasco, like a conjugation of a verb almost. These spellings lead to actual errors of all sorts. The book is a story of many mistaken identities and misjudgments and so on. And this painter, did his name begin with a B or did it begin with a V? And all of it is complicated by the fact that Velázquez, who I should call Velázquez, as even I am really, after all this time, not any good at pronouncing his name correctly. And it's pronounced three different ways in Spain, I might add, legitimately. This painter didn't sign his paintings. He didn't date his paintings. There are no titles for his paintings. His work is in an era anyway before titles were the convention. There are so many ways in which it was possible in those days, and still remains so, to confuse a Velázquez. And just to talk about him, I mean, I feel even now some degree of shyness about using his name. I prefer to call him by his first name, actually, Diego, because it's easier than creating a solecism as you refer to him.
You've already mentioned some reasons for the question I'm going to ask next, but the title, The Vanishing Man, could refer to John Snare, the Victorian bookseller from Reading, who we're going to talk about later. It could refer to the portrait of Charles I, which he becomes obsessed with. And it could refer to Velázquez, because for some of the reasons I said you've already mentioned, but other ones I want to go into, he is mysterious. So first of all, as you said, he's not particularly well known over here, even though a lot of people consider him to be, you know, one of the greatest painters. But also, he was in this sort of unique situation of being like a court painter. But then the painters just never left Spain, really, for a long time as well. What sort of reasons are there for him being so mysterious?
Well, there's his character, which we'll come to, which I find intensely appealing and intensely mysterious, and the two are linked. But in terms of his art, as you rightly say, he's this genius boy in Seville to begin with. He's only there for a very short time. His works are so magnificent that even as a teenager he's painting pieces that we regard as some of the world's greatest masterpieces. And then he's eager to get out of Seville and get to Madrid, and people come occasionally and buy his paintings and they take them back to Madrid. Eventually he gets there, probably around about the age of 19, and he paints at that point, very fast and very brilliantly, a sequence of portraits, one of which gets taken to the palace. The paint was barely dry, says the account by his father-in-law, who wrote the only surviving biography of him written in his own lifetime. And this painting gets to the palace. Everybody in the palace is in awe. The king sees it. He's speechless. He commissions him to come and paint the royal person, which he does. And at this point, Velázquez very, very rapidly goes from the Seville teenager to a tremendously important member of the court. He becomes court painter within a year, and he never leaves. There are only two recorded trips out of Spain at all, both of them to Rome, and the rest of his life he spends in the palace. Palaces, plural, in fact, because he moves between two or three of them, and he is in charge eventually of decorating the palaces, of organising the paintings on the walls. He becomes the palace curator. He paints all of his pictures in the palace, the greatest of them, in my view, the greatest painting ever made, Las Meninas, the Maid Servants, shows a room in that palace, a room, in fact, that he has himself organised and arranged and so on and hung the paintings. And he never leaves, and we are able to tell a little bit. There are not many documents that tell us about Velázquez the man at all, but there are some surviving documents that show us his progression through the palace. So here's the place he first lives, a couple of rooms, then he moves to bigger rooms, he gets a better job, he goes up the ladder of the palace bureaucracy until he eventually, in fact, reaches the top. He lives, his family move into the palace, and so the palace is no longer, the Alcazar is, alas, no longer, because it burned down, but its walls in some parts were 4 feet thick, and you see them in the paintings in this very, very dense crepuscular light, these very shadowy paintings, and I feel you can sense this sort of the confinement of the paintings and of the life within the palace. You're right, they don't leave. He's only known to have made two or three commissions of a tiny number of paintings, 110 possibly to 120. People say, rightly, that he measured his genius in thimblefuls. So hardly any work in the span of a career from about 20 to about 60 when he dies. And all of it stays there. These are portraits of people who lived in the palace. They are commissioned by the kings and queens. Nobody's going to let them go because they show the royal family and the royal court, the dwarves, entertainers, the maidservants and so on. So nothing is getting out of those palaces. When he goes to Rome, he does make paintings which were bought, in some cases, by the sitters. But even in Rome, where he painted some of his most tremendous paintings, when he possibly could, he kept them. He didn't sell them. You know, the gardens of the Villa Medici, a magnificent, tiny painting of this place where he's staying. He goes outside into the garden. First and only time he ever goes outside in any of his art, really. He shows the light falling on this beautiful Italian landscape. He brings it home. He doesn't leave it there. He doesn't give it to anyone or sell it to anyone. Even some of the portraits he painted there, he brought back with him. So I think of him very much as a man who didn't want to let his paintings go. And indeed, the very first painting that made him famous, he bought back when he could, when it was for sale, the owner of it died. He bought it straight back and kept it with him, and it was there when he died, in the palace.
And of course, it doesn't help that, you know, he starts off as a painter who becomes a courtier to the king, and ends up a courtier to the king who also paints, really, because the bureaucracy gets more and more in the way of his actual painting.
Yes, I mean, we say that, but of course we don't really know, and it is a heartache for anyone who loves Velázquez and all the painters who've ever written about him, and many have, because he is the great painter's painter, that he painted so little. The question is, did he paint so little because he wanted to? Did he paint so little because he was encumbered by all these kind of jobs, you know? At the very end of his life, we see him going to organise all the ornaments and decorations and design, effectively, the wedding for the king's youngest child in the Isle of Pheasants, border between Spain and France. And, you know, he's even designed the plates. So certainly we know that he was an incredibly industrious servant of the court, and that he must, I think we could probably deduce, that he must have had great ambitions to be a courtier. And yet we also surely can see from the work that he knew he was a great painter. When I think about these lost paintings, there are some literally lost paintings, and then there are the paintings that he didn't ever paint because he was doing other things. I console myself with the simple thought that the paintings that survive are so great. When we think, you know, are there any other Velázquez in the history of art? Well, no, there are none. And, you know, thousands of other people's paintings could make one of his. He was a slow worker, it is thought, certainly in later years. I also think strongly the evidence seems to me to suggest that he painted for himself. He chose what he wanted to paint. And this would make him really unique as a court painter, because that job, you know, it's mugshots, it's marriage portraits, it's diplomacy portraits. You send them out into the world. The king says, I'll have 10 of those. You know, even other very great artists who were court painters, they really had to hold to a schedule of commissions. There are letters, surviving letters, from Philip IV to his confessor, a nun, saying that, you know, I can't get him to concentrate on these paintings that I've ordered. I can't get him to finish the portrait of the young Infanta, which I need to send to Prague, because he isn't getting on with it. And even on one of these trips to Rome, he stops off in Milan, where he's supposed to paint a picture for the king, and he actually sidesteps the commissioner and goes to see The Last Supper instead. I think you can say so much from that.
I'm Emma Jane Unsworth. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Before we look at some of the paintings in a bit more detail, how did you come to Velázquez? What does it mean to you?
I always get a bit choked up when I think of this moment, because he means everything to me. He changed my life. I think it's not an understatement to say this, and I have started the book by saying so, and I mean it from the heart. I loved his paintings anyway. When I was in my 20s, I knew them quite well because I grew up in Edinburgh, where there is his magnificent painting, The Old Woman Frying Eggs, which contains that little pan of eggs, and the eggs are resolving from liquid to solid, from translucency to whiteness and so on, and it's the most magical piece of painting. He's probably about 17 or 18 when he made it. So I knew that painting, and of course I had been to London, and where we have amazingly a plethora practically of paintings by Velázquez. But I'd never been to Madrid until my father died, and he died, he was a painter himself, and he died very suddenly and very terribly from cancer, which took his eyesight. And I had made this vow that I would never look at anyone's paintings but his ever again. You can see quite clearly I've broken this vow because I'm an art critic now. But I felt that I could honour my father, I suppose, by that vow. Impractical and impossible vow. And I had managed to succeed in it for, I think, about 9, 10 months. And I really hadn't looked at anything at all. And I had his paintings around me in the house. And then I went to Madrid, and I went to Madrid in a sort of blissful ignorance, because it never really occurred to me that I'd be so tempted by the Prado that I wouldn't be able to resist going in. But I was there in winter, and I walked around Madrid, and Madrid isn't very big, as you know, and the more I walked round and round and round the city centre, you know, the more often I passed the Prado. And eventually I kind of allowed myself to, continuing with my vow, honour my father by going in and looking at El Greco, who was his favourite painter. And I thought that if I just followed, I had a map, which, as you know, has no, they don't generally have images on them, those floor maps. And I thought if I followed the floor map, I would eventually find the El Greco by looking at the ground, and I'd just look up and there would be the El Greco, and then I could kind of leave with impunity. And instead, this is what happened to me. I was passing the opening of the gallery where this painting hangs, and I felt this sort of terrific optical frisson in my peripheral vision, and a light, a kind of light that didn't seem a very natural, or even it's almost a supernatural light, I suppose it has to it. And I'm afraid I just instantly turned and looked, and there was Las Meninas, and in front of it was standing a crowd of tourists, and I couldn't at the time quite distinguish the real, and this is the greatness in part, in fraction of the greatness of this painting, is of course that its reality approaches a kind of mirror reality and a brightness, a sort of optical brightness. And I, just looking fleetingly, I saw these people and something that seemed to be more of the room behind them. And then they moved away and I realised that I was looking at a painting. And of course the painting is as large as life and so magnificent. And what it shows, as your listeners will know, is a split second. We can say that of all paintings. They all show a split second if they're showing a scene that actually exists. And even those that have imaginary scenes, you know, painting stops time is a kind of cliche we say about it, stops time. But this painting makes the stopping of time part of its content, it seems to me. So looking at it, you see this gathering of figures on this particular morning, perhaps late morning, on a day in the palace in 1656, all these years ago, and they're standing in a pool of light, which is arranged by Velázquez. It's coming through shutters that have been specially angled, and it falls down upon this little group of figures. And they do have this appearance of twinkling and expectancy. They're waiting for you. There's the painter, Velázquez himself, behind his easel, just stepping out. There's a dog and a dwarf and a nun and a bodyguard, and right at the back of the painting, this marvellous dark figure, a sort of perfect silhouette, cut-out figure, standing in a doorway filled with light that looks like that. I mean, if you're this way inclined at this moment, when you first see it, you may have the sensation some people have later, which is that that figure is going into the next world. It's taking you on into a sort of everlasting light in the next world. And in my state of mind, all of these things came to me so powerfully that, of course, I immediately began to cry, because it seemed to be showing you the dead alive in this minute, and they were waiting for you, and they're still there. They're still there because of this great painting. But most singularly of all, the sensation that the painter gives is that this is all only happening, not just because of his painting, but because of you. You have arrived, you've seen them, you complete the picture, you complete the moment, they see you, you see them. It's a sort of never-ending transmission. You're effectively keeping them alive. And all of this comes to you, really, I promise, in a split second when you see this painting. And it goes on feeling like that the longer you stand in front of it. So it never loses that extraordinary, instant, immediate potency. And it made me feel that the dead could be alive in this painting, which is like a chamber of the mind. And I found it very, very intensely comforting. And it sort of broke the vow for me, effectively. I was able to go back with some real comfort coming from a painting, not from conversations with people, not from looking at photographs of my father or thinking about me, but from this painting by this Spaniard I'd never met.
The man who's the figure walking through the door, looking to step through the door at the back, it turns out is a man, another courtier, José Nito Velázquez, although it takes a long time before anybody realises that. He also appears in you know, numerous of Velázquez's paintings. This portrait now can be seen, well, it can't actually because it's closed for renovations as we speak, but it should be seen in Apsley House in London. I was going to go and try and see it before we came and only just discovered that it was closed. It's on the cover of the book as well, this portrait. It has a rather bizarre story of how it ends up in Apsley House. Tell us that story. And this also involves, I was amazed to discover, I didn't realise this, my own favourite painting, which is the Arnolfini portrait, which also happened to be on this same journey. So how did the portrait get to Wellington's house?
Well, the portrait, which, as you say, is of the Queen's Chamberlain, Velázquez is the King's Chamberlain, José Nieto Velázquez, also Velázquez, is the Queen's Chamberlain. They're opposite numbers and so on in the palace. And who he painted the picture for? Well, I don't know. I just think it's another one he painted for himself. He clearly is absolutely on equal terms with this marvellously intelligent, dark-eyed figure. I think they're great friends. Nobody can, of course, prove that, but I feel that the paintings intimate that. So it's in the palace, and years, decades, and almost two centuries later, the Napoleonic invasion of Spain occurs, and the painting, towards the end of this Peninsular War, the painting is stolen. Yeah, I think that's the word for it, stolen, along with a lot of other great works of art from Spanish collections, specifically the Royal Collection, were taken by Joseph Bonaparte back through Spain on this kind of flight that he takes over months and months, pursued hotly by the Duke of Wellington and the British Army, who are there to kind of, you know, save the Spaniards. And they eventually have their last encounter almost at the border in a town called Vitoria in 1813. And there is a terrible, terrible bloodbath of a battle. 10,000 men were killed in a few short hours on this hot June day, and this terrible campaign between the two of them. Joseph Bonaparte flees, leaving behind what's always called his baggage train, which is kind of a strange term for what he's leaving, but basically it is all of his personal carriages, including the one he slept in with a bed in it and so on, and lots of donkeys and lots of backpacks and lots of chests and a lot of trophies of war. And the British army come along and gather things up. And in Bonaparte's personal carriage, they find a cache of paintings, and one of them is the portrait of Nieto, and the other one of the others is the one that you love so much, which is the Arnolfini portrait in the National Gallery here in London. And it is horrifying, I think you'll agree, to imagine the damage, the potential damage, the damage. I mean, I think there was some damage. There were three paintings by Velázquez. These paintings literally are in the blood and mire. I mean, they're just on the ground. They are on the ground. And some of the paintings in there that were being stolen were being used as tarpaulins on the backs of horses and donkeys. And it's incredible. It just shows you, I think, paintings as objects, these curious sort of vulnerable things that move around the world. They're more resilient than I think we ever really know that they are. I mean, you can wash them without destroying them, and you can drop them on a field and abandon them. Bonaparte, incidentally, had a kind of A-list and a B-list, and the A-list featured, the really kind of well-known artists, so it had the Leonardos on it, and they went to Paris. But the ones he wasn't sure about, and the Spanish, riffraff Spanish, were left behind, which is why there are no paintings by Velázquez in France, and there are several in London. The Duke of Wellington picks them up, takes them back, has crisis of conscience, writes regularly for I think 2.5 years he wrote to the Spanish government saying, do you want these pictures back? And eventually a diplomat intervenes and says, look, just hang on to them. You saved Spain. It's really a small thing for you to keep these pictures. And that is how they ended up at number one London, as it's known, Apsley House on the edge of Hyde Park.
I'm Andy Miller, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
We talked about, obviously, that Velázquez was his main occupation was painting portraits of Philip IV, that, weird-looking Habsburg king of Spain. And he does, he paints portraits of him right through his life. Obviously, Philip outlives Velázquez, but there's clearly a sequence of paintings all through his life. But I think one of the things that obviously demonstrates the humanism of Velázquez is that he paints everybody, as you already mentioned, in the palace as well. And I wanted to talk about sort of a couple of the portraits that you reproduce in the book, of Sebastián de Mora and Francisco Lezcano, who are two of the dwarves, and also this actor, the painting that Manet saw, went to see and basically said, that's it, I may as well not bother.
Exactly. Yes, that's the portrait of Pablo de Valladolid, and it's in the Prado, and I just think it's fascinating that Manet goes on a long and miserable journey on the first direct train from Paris to Madrid. He hated Spanish food, he hated the hotel, he hated everything about it, except the painting. There was a cholera epidemic, so he was quite brave to go. But he really went to look at Velázquez, and his greatest of all paintings is not, interestingly, Las Meninas, which is a very kind of unusual view. Instead, he goes for Pablo, and this is this fantastic sort of coup de théâtre of a painting. The figure of Pablo, this very, very strong, dark-haired, dark-eyed actor wearing black, and he's making a fantastically sort of extravagant gesture, one hand holding all of his sort of strength inside his body, and the other hand's reaching out, very kind of thespian gesture. And the figure appears, apparently anchored to nothing at all. It just appears in this beautiful kind of tawny light, as if the only thing that's holding him into the painting is, of course, Velázquez's wonderful brushwork and his fabulous contour outlines, and the character's actor's own presence, his own sort of force of personality. I think it's a tremendous painting. And as Manet says of the painting, he stands on nothing but air. One of the things about Velázquez is so remarkable is the feeling of circumambient air in his paintings, all of them. There is this sense of light and air moving around figures in rooms that I think you don't see anywhere else in art. So, yes, this room in the palace, was it a room in the palace? Was he even, I don't know where Pablo would have been, though obviously it must have been somewhere in the Alcazar. Certainly the painting hung down the end of a corridor, and I love to think of Pablo coming upon himself. A great double moment, a great double act between the painter and his colleague, because Pablo was his colleague. Again, it's a painting, like the paintings of dwarves that you mentioned, in which he's just painting his equals. And again, I feel that there is a strong, palpable empathy between the sitter and the painter. You feel they've been in a room talking, you feel they work together, you feel that they know each other quite well. The portrait of the little dwarf in green, Francisco, you mentioned, is to me, writing the book was an incredibly controversial test point, because I saw the painting when it came to London in the great National Gallery show in 2007, and I was amazed. I'd never seen it and really looked at it. Perhaps I'd never really looked at it enough in reality in Madrid, but I was amazed by how loving it seemed. This little dwarf, he has a chondroplasia, which is known as short-limbed dwarfism. He's sitting up on a rock, so straight away he's been elevated, and he has a very, very gentle expression. He's a very gentle character, and the brushwork is very gentle, so you sense the fusion of the form and the content there, that, you know, this is an expression of his personality, just as the painting of Pablo is of his. And he's dressed in green, and he's holding a little, possibly a pack of cards, possibly a small notebook, it's hard to tell. And he's on a day out. He's not at court, he's away out in the landscape, and lovely, distant, sunny days in the hills. One of the only other paintings in which Velázquez shows the outdoor world. And I feel there's a great affection between them. Well, the painting was seen by an American critic. I better not say who he was because he's terribly well known. And he said, what a horrible little psychopath that guy is sitting on that rock. You know, he could be a real little killer, couldn't he? And I was very shocked because that piece came out around the time we were all reviewing the show, and I couldn't believe anybody could think that about him. And this is sometime before I started writing the book, but I went to look what other people had said just to kind of settle the hash for me, you know, what had people thought, and he was not alone. There were many writers over centuries since the painting was made who had thought that this was a vicious painting or a critical painting or a painting that showed what the director of the Prado, even in the 1980s, described as an abortion of nature. That was a sort of tremendously pivotal moment for me. I remember when that happened thinking, right, as soon as I start writing this book about Velázquez, I'm going to go in hard on this one. You know, I'm determined that people should cease to think that because in the 17th century and the 18th century, court dwarves were perhaps deformities. They were often described as monsters and deformities and so on. The outrage of this, with this dwarf, his actual suffering is very well, his condition is well known. Achondroplasia has absolutely no correlation whatsoever with the health of the person or the mental health of the person. So the idea that he's kind of homicidal maniac or that, you know, he's abnormally stupid, which is another thing that is often said about the dwarves in the paintings, is an outrage. Nobody has ever established any such link between these conditions, the physical condition, and any kind of mental state of this sort. So I felt that very strongly, and when you go to the Prado, you'll see that that painting hangs in a room with two other paintings of dwarves, including the wonderful portrait of Sebastián de Mora, who was a soldier and a diplomat. I mean, you know, he was an extraordinarily important and advanced figure in the royal court. Indeed, he was tutor to the king's eldest son, who would one day have been king had he not died at the age of 16, also of plague. And this prince, in his will, leaves his best silver dagger to the dwarf in friendship. You know, I mean, it seems to me that if you look at art history, it's always plagued by the issues of documentation and what can we establish about art from looking at documents and so on. Well, here is an actual instance of something you can read back into the painting from a document, which is the honour and respect that Velázquez shows towards this figure of the dwarf in his red cloak, so defiant and so soldierly.
Just to finish off this first part of the show, we've mentioned already a couple of times that Velázquez is widely considered, and certainly by yourself, to be among the greatest of all painters. And we've given reasons why, you know, perhaps he's not as well known as other painters are. But why is he considered so good? Can you sum up what's so great about him as a painter?
Well, there is what he paints, of course, and that is in its own right so moving and so dignified and so beautiful, and for me, very Shakespearean. I mean, we always say Rembrandt's the great, you know, Shakespeare of art, but for me, it's Velázquez any day. Every person who comes before him is painted in soul, in character, in spirit, and in the moment in their life, with the knowledge that life is passing, which I think is really exceptional. And the way that he paints indicates the moment passing. It seems to hold the moment passing. So I would say about Las Meninas that it shows you this, you know, brilliant kind of moment of, you know, little kids like bright as fireflies in this sunny moment, sunspot in time in the room. But it also shows you a world and a group of people who are passing, and it holds them there on the edge, in the brushwork itself, between appearing and disappearing. So although you can see, and I think this goes to the heart of why painters love his work so much, although you can see all of Velázquez's brushwork very clearly, he's not an impressionist, he doesn't kind of blur, you know, you can see all of these brushstrokes in his work, you can analyse them very carefully, but you can't quite see how these special effects are working on your eye. And in the case of Las Meninas, there's this moment you walk towards the painting and it seems to swither between a very concrete version of reality and an absolutely vanishing depiction, so that you don't really know where one figure begins and the other one ends and so on. And as an example in the book of one of the things that had made him distinctive, I've mentioned a painting that was one of many paintings that have very recently turned up. This is a painting found in Kent, here in Kent, in someone's house, hanging over the proverbial fireplace. When they x-rayed this painting that the family was selling because they needed, they were in financial difficulty and needed to sell the painting, what they found on the x-ray was something really spectacular and really unique, which is nothing, nothing. When you look at the x-ray of this huge life-size x-ray of the painting, which is a portrait of a Spanish courtier, a wonderful painting, the master of the hunt, we think he is. And there's nothing, there's no beginning, no ending, no underpainting, no overpainting, no corrections. It's a really unique x-ray for an old master artist. You just don't know how he did it. It's like condensation on a mirror.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Listen to Little Atoms. I'm Niels Denny, and today I'm talking to Laura Cumming, and we're talking about her book, The Vanishing Man in Pursuit of Velázquez. And Laura, we've been talking about Velázquez for half an hour, but one portrait we've not really mentioned yet is one at the centre of this book, which is, we could perhaps say, a mythical portrait of Charles I, the executed King of England. So what was that painting? Tell us something about the background of that painting.
It's not a mythical portrait, I wouldn't say. Perhaps we could say it was a legendary portrait, because it really did exist. It was painted on a late August day in 1623, possibly an early September day, certainly within 1 week, a very narrow period, in Madrid, in the Alcázar Palace, and it showed Charles I of England when he was still a prince. Charles has arrived on an absolutely disastrous mission with the Duke of Buckingham, who was the King James I's favourite, possibly his lover, who knows, and they arrive, these two, disguised as the Smiths with sort of false beards and so on, and they arrived in Madrid with the aim of trying to woo the Spanish Infanta to unite the kingdoms of Britain and Spain. And it was a terrible set of complexities, diplomatic complexities. Neither side really could pull it off. One of them's Catholic, one of them's Protestant, the Pope is involved. Enormous numbers of parties are thrown. The Spanish are horrified because they weren't expecting this visitor. The Duke of Buckingham behaves terribly badly. Everything goes wrong, and above all things, the Spanish Infanta is totally averse to this very small, 5'3" he was, Charles I, this small man with a strong Scottish accent and a bit of a lisp and a stutter and a little bit lame and so on, who turns up. And she's not impressed with him at all, and she certainly never wanted to marry him. So the whole thing was a catastrophe, really, and it cost a fortune. But one great thing, as historians have always said, that came out of it was the portrait that Charles commissioned from Velázquez. He was a lover of art, as everybody knows, and so was Philip IV. And they're young men. They're young men, and they're all of them, all three of these people, are very young, in their early 20s. And Philip has already got this star genius painter from Seville making these marvellous images in his palace. And Charles wants one too, and they meet for probably a matter of 2 or 3 hours, probably not more, and a painting is created, a portrait of Charles. And at this point, it is extremely difficult to know what happened to it. This is the story of John Snare, a Victorian autodidact, a bookseller in Reading, who believes that he finds this painting by chance at an auction at Radley Hall, which is now Radley College and was indeed then also a boys' school, a different boys' school. It was going bust, this boys' school, and all the paintings on the walls were being sold, and this painting, which he came upon, was one of them. About the painting, there are two records of its existence. One in the account written, a biography of Velázquez written by his father-in-law that I mentioned earlier, and the other is the payment made by the British court to Velázquez for the painting. So we know that it existed. And from then on, its whereabouts, its story is a mystery. And certainly John Snare believed he'd found it. I don't want to give away too much of the story of the book, but he's not the only one in history who thought that he had found it. And indeed, the whereabouts of that painting, in the time that I've been writing the book, I've heard three different versions of what became of that painting. So it goes to America eventually with John Snare in the second half of the 19th century. And there are Americans who think that the painting is still in America. And there are Spaniards, great authorities, I must bow to them, who think it never left Spain. I know that the painting that belonged to John Snare isn't in Spain and isn't in America, and that it came back to Britain. What happens to it next is a mystery. Not to me quite, but...
So tell us a bit more about who John Snare is. So he's this basically provincial bookseller in Reading. And, of course, because of that, in his quest to sort of prove that this painting he buys is a Velázquez, there's a lot of snobbery involved, that this sort of counter jumper is basically questioning gentleman experts and things.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Neil. I mean, in a way, there's a sort of class war theme to the book, which not everybody notices, but I felt it kind of keenly, because the more he encounters the might of the aristocracy in various places in London, but specifically in Edinburgh, where there's a terrible trial that's going to come to him, he's going to have the painting stolen away from him, effectively, the more I felt that it was a tale of a humble, what he calls himself in the many pamphlets that he wrote. And he really did write a lot of pamphlets, and some of them are very long, you know, in defence of his painting, and I suppose ultimately in defence of his feelings for Velázquez. He calls himself a humble provincial tradesman, and that is what he was. He's probably may have been educated, I think, to probably the age of about 12, maybe maximum 13, in Reading, in the board schools there in the middle of the 19th century. And what he is a reader. He's employed as a young teenager by his uncle, who owns the bookshop, and he reads. And they have developed a sideline in printing, and the more they print, the more they read. He begins to read about art, and there are no places for him to look at art at all, really. The National Gallery's only just opened. Stately homes of Britain are all shut to him. He can't see paintings in practically any place at all. Though, interestingly, Wellington opened his house, Apsley House, to the public, bless him. So many people got to see these three paintings by Velázquez, which were in that collection. So Snare is a kind of goer to auctions, because this is the moment at which a painting changing hands between two wealthy people will appear briefly to the public, because there were public viewing days. And it's thus that he comes across his Velázquez.
And bearing in mind that, you know, he's not a particularly well-educated man, but also it goes without saying that at this point it was very, very difficult to see paintings by Velázquez. Why does he believe that's what it is?
Yes, well, that's the absolutely key, crucial question. Why does he believe it's what it is? Well, the first reason, actually, is part of his sort of autodidact pedantry, in a way, which I'm rather affected by, if I'm touched by it. He's a bit of a royalist. He could have been a thing about Charles I. This is the lost king. 19th century people thought this was a rather romantic figure. He had his head chopped off, you know, he's the lost king of England and so on. And he had, at that point in his life, been kind of pursuing images of Charles I. He's not alone in this. It was a big vogue at that point in the middle of the 19th century. And he's really familiar with images of Charles, partly because the British Museum, also bless the British Museum, which had a massive collection of prints. You could go there, members of the public could go there, it's a proper democratic organisation, you could go and look at these images. And he reckoned himself, and I think he's right, because I've, say, following somewhat in his footsteps, I've looked at everything I can look at everywhere. He thinks to himself, this picture that is supposed to show Charles I when he's a young prince doesn't look like anything else. And it doesn't, because in the painting he is not, as he might appear in early court paintings, he's wearing the wrong clothes, he's got a beard, he's got this Spanish beard. And so the Spanish beard is very significant, because this is what he quite self-evidently grows in Spain, as to become sort of part of the Spanish court and look kind of cool in Spain. So it's a very precise time this image shows. And after 1623, all sorts of people paint Charles, but they never paint him standing like this, posing like this, wearing these kinds of clothes, and so on. And the next person who comes along to paint Charles is Van Dyck, who's, of course, the great coiner of the image of Charles I that we all have in our head, this sort of silken cavalier look. And it certainly doesn't look like a Van Dyck. So there's a little... I've put that rather in a rather kind of specific way to give the sense of revelation that John Snow has when he climbs up this borrowed ladder in Radley Hall to look closely at this rather sort of filthy black rectangle when he famously wets his fingers and cleans the face with his fingers. It isn't a Van Dyck. So what is it?
Well,
so
you just said it clearly doesn't look like a Van Dyck, but everybody thinks it is, and that's certainly what it's for sale as.
It's certain, yes, in the auction it's supposed Van Dyck is what it says, half-length supposed Van Dyck, that's right. And you know, he hasn't got any good reason, no good reason to think it's a Velázquez, not at all. But he's got a little hope, and that is how all discoveries of paintings start. I mean, this is, or rediscoveries, we should say, of paintings start. So he goes back to the auction with his pal, and, you know, and he puts in a bid through a dealer because he's too nervous to bid himself. And the painting comes in at £8, which is a very small amount of money from the point of view of Velázquez. Big for John Snow, big, a lot of money. It's about the price of a cart horse in the middle of the 19th century. He's disappointed because he thinks surely somebody else would have come in. I mean, oh God, this inferiority complex goes to work, and he thinks, oh, you know, wish I hadn't bought it now, and so on. And he hasn't brought anything to carry it with him home. I think probably think he wouldn't have been able to bid for it, actually. And so he has to go all the way back to Reading on one of these early steam trains, disappointed, and terrible problems occur. He can't get it out of the stately home, and the police come while he tries to climb in the window, and so on. But eventually he gets it back to his shop in Reading, and he's disappointed until he takes water and washes it properly. And then this kind of glow comes, and he sees this rather spectral dissolving brushwork, and he thinks, oh, yeah, maybe this is by someone greater than Van Dyck.
I'm Olivia Lang, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So let's talk about how he goes about trying to convince people that it is a Velázquez. He obviously writes to some experts. Some people believe it is, some people believe it isn't. But certainly it's not, like, once he starts showing the painting in London, enough people believe that he has found the Velázquez, don't they? I'm talking about,
oh, yes,
you know,
other,
yes, you know, the fugitive sort of art critics and experts.
Yes, I mean, really, 51 British publications, newspapers, The Times, everybody all come out, you know, with this absolutely thrilled, excited response to the painting, saying, at last, you know, we have a new Velázquez. It's wonderful to see this marvellous painting. One of the people who visits it in Old Bond Street, where he's showing it, is the exiled King of Spain, soi-disant, we should say, who grew up in the Alcazar and says, oh, it's a Velázquez, how great, and so on. So he has a huge, I mean, really everybody agrees that this painting is by Velázquez, and, you know, from Wellington to the, you know, high society to art critics and writers and so on in this sort of emerging art writing tradition in Britain. They were all thrilled with it. He only has two opponents, but they are mighty opponents. And one of them is Sir Edmund Head, the art writer, and the other one is Sir William Stirling Maxwell, who is a Scot, an MP, an antiquary, a tremendous traveller who had been to Madrid, as Snare could never go to Madrid. He would never have been able to afford to go there. And so poor Snare's first enemy, effectively, is Stirling Maxwell, who is, at this point, the foremost expert on Spanish painting in Britain. And he does not think it's a Velázquez. So this point, his life turns somewhat, and he starts to write the pamphlets that I mentioned to defend his painting, but also to produce the backstory, which he must produce to have some, to make sense of how on earth a bookseller in Reading finds it in a boys' boarding school. And it is in this part of his endeavour that I really admire John Snow, because he works himself practically to death to find a sort of trajectory and to show how it might have got from A to B, from B to C, and so on, how it turns up where it does. And I think examining all his, he becomes a kind of detective, and following him and seeing what he detects, I cannot fault him. I went, you know, with all the resources of EasyJet and the internet, I can't fault him until I fault him. And then I do, right at the end of the book, discover something he didn't know. And what he didn't know is so distressing. I mean, you know, it's a sort of tragedy right at the end of the book, because actually his life was ruined by this painting, and it could have been otherwise, I think.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that backstory, how he sort of establishes the pedigree of the painting, where it's come from, how it ended up in Radley Hall, how it ended up in that sale, or at least how he thinks, because that's central to what happens when he takes it on the road, ends up in Edinburgh, showing it in Edinburgh to the public, and then a couple of bailiffs turn up, basically.
So, yeah,
so tell us, take us to there.
It's an extraordinary scene. It's hanging in a hotel in deepest January in the dark afternoon in 1849 in Edinburgh, in Princes Street, in this hotel. Princes Street, of all places, now a great kind of, you know, shopping thoroughfare. And as you say, these two policemen come and lift it. Well, actually, they're sergeant officers, they're called, and they come and take it on behalf of a, at that point, unknown client. And they remove it and they drag it along Princes Street in icy conditions up the Mound, if your listeners know this journey, across the Mound, across the Royal Mile, and down into the Lawn Market, which is where the county court is. And they hand it in to the policeman in duty, who's absolutely, there's a testimony, court testimony of this, who's horrified because this incredibly famous painter, here is this painting, and they're, you know, giving it to him, and he's got to keep it. And he has a box made, and he seals it with his own personal seal, and he promises no one that he will, you know, it won't be touched, it'll be safe, and they stick it in the vaults underneath the court. And poor Snare, who's absolutely devastated by this, is sort of running to keep up and, you know, trying to prevail. And the reason that they have taken it is on the grounds that it is stolen goods. Stolen when? Nobody knows. Stolen how? Nobody asserts. But stolen from whom? We have the answer, which is the Earl of Fife. And the Earl of Fife was who's now, at this point in the story, long since dead, in fact, but he lived in Whitehall. He had a magnificent red Georgian house in Whitehall, and he owned Velázquez's portrait of Charles as a prince painted in 1623, etc. So he owned this painting, or was it this painting, as you will find out from reading the book. Anyway, he believes it's been stolen, or rather his heirs think it has been stolen. So they take it from Snare on the grounds that he must have stolen it. He is able to prove that he didn't steal it, but at the same time, they believe it's theirs. So the painting is impounded, and there comes a Jarndyce versus Jarndyce lawsuit, which goes through 10 appeals and several years. And during the course of it, Snare, you won't be at all surprised to hear, Snare goes bankrupt because he can't pay for the Scottish lawyers and so on. And again, it's a very, to me, an extraordinary kind of classist trial, because the prosecution for the Earl's side of it, who include all the kind of members of the Scottish aristocracy and the Scottish, you know, power brokers, Royal Academicians in Scotland and so on, they're all involved in, you know, trying to do him down. And they refer to him as this little man from the other side of the Tweed, you know, who's very like to make off with the painting if we hand it back to him and so on. So he can't get it back. So he goes bankrupt. And at this point, Snare, to refer to your very perceptive remark about the title, becomes the vanishing man because I can't find him. I just couldn't work out where he'd gone. He doesn't seem to be... He's not in Reading. The bankruptcy sale makes no mention of him. He's not there. His wife's about to give birth to their fourth child. He's not in Edinburgh, as far as I could find him, for a minute, just about in the new town, staying in a one-room flat. And then I just lose him, and I don't know where he's gone. And it took me some time to find out that he was, in fact, with the painting in New York.
And he just basically scarpered. He does actually, we can say, he does, you know, eventually wins the trial. But by that time, he's already gone. That's sort of irrelevant because he's already scarpered to New York. But just stay with the trial for a second. There's this like incredible thing that happens during it. That the trustees basically are saying that, you know, he's got this painting. He's stolen the painting. Basically, he's in receipt of this... what everybody should presume is this incredibly valuable old master that somehow he shouldn't have. But the way they actually fight it is by saying, it's a forgery, it's worthless. Yeah.
Yes,
so they're basically saying, the Earl of Fife owned this worthless copy of this painting, which he now has.
Yes. It's a most tortured and peculiar trial because they actually have to shoot themselves in the foot in order to win. So it has to be valueless and yet incredibly valuable, as you rightly say. And the proceedings of the trial are extraordinary. Their transcript, I found it in the National Library in Scotland, and it is amazing because it's filled with people all knocking the painting on one side and picking it up on the other side. So there are lots of people who say, oh, it's complete kind of rubbish, you know, absolutely nothing. And then there are other people saying it's the best Velasquez I've seen in my lifetime. And nobody can agree on what a Velasquez really looks like. That's the nub of it. And they can't because there are so few Velasquez paintings in this country at this point. So they're all basing it on, you know, a very, very tiny group of paintings. And at this point, you will have noticed in the book, Velasquez is practically flooding the market. So though we know now, through the painstaking scholarship of many Velasquez experts, that he painted practically nothing, a huge number of paintings by Velasquez were supposedly coming into Britain. There were 77 in Sir William Sterling Maxwell's Guide to Velasquez. 77, there were only 44 in the Prado. So you can see that the question of what a painting looked like in the age before the camera, before... there weren't very many prints of paintings either. You couldn't see them in galleries. There were no illustrated catalogues. People could hardly get to Spain. The journey took weeks. The chances of you knowing really well what a Velasquez might look like were limited. And it's in these kind of dark days that the people in this trial are having these, to us now, preposterous squabbles. And yet, even now in our time, people do not agree about what a Raphael looks like, what a Velasquez looks like. Experts clash all the time. In the absence of any forensic or documentary evidence to prove conclusively what a painting might be, we are all susceptible to using the one dependable thing we have, which is judgment and our own two eyes.
I'm Greg Jenner. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Snare ends up in New York with the painting. The whole thing starts again. He starts exhibiting it. There's this great scene in the book of the sort of the beginnings of the art scene in Broadway, on Broadway in New York. And what's fascinating here is that the novelty of the thing is that this is probably, or it's certainly sold as, probably the first Vasquez ever to have set foot over the Atlantic. Right?
You know, the odd thing is that John Snare doesn't really say that. He says in his advertisements and in his pamphlets about it in New York that it's a rare example of this unknown great Spaniard and so on, but he actually is quite careful never to say it's the first. I, on the other hand, am saying, as far as I can see from the internet and reading and catalogues and so on, I think it is the first vaunted Velasquez in America, yeah. I mean, America at this point is, you rightly say you're looking at the development of the art market on Broadway, and that is a fantastically advanced thing, even in 1851, which is when I think he arrives there. It's Gangs of New York, really. You know, it's the Scorsese scene going on around. And yet, with this thoroughfare lined with magnificent houses and wonderful new shops and galleries and so on. So it's a very brilliant and fascinating period of New York's history, it seems to me, because you do have actual cowboys and you do have actual puffed French dealers all kind of mingling in the streets of Manhattan. Wonderful time. And he lives on Broadway. He lives on Broadway for the rest of his life. He moves gradually from his first job, where he's kind of hanging out at the Stuyvesant Institute, which is a sort of a place where, you know, workers had lectures and pictures were shown, and photography in its first daguerreotypes were very first shown in New York, and so on. And he gets a kind of job, he gets a foothold in there as a sort of caretaker, and then he elevates himself to curator and so on. And eventually, a collection of Egyptian artifacts arrives and is shown there. Now these priceless and magnificent Egyptian jewels are on show permanently at the Brooklyn Museum. He's the first person to look after them, and so on. And there's a marvellous description, I believe it's by Mark Twain. I haven't conclusively been able to prove that, but
Twain had the Buffalo newspaper.
The Buffalo newspaper, the Buffalo Herald, and he's writing. Twain was writing for this paper at this time, a sort of weekly column showing a picture from Metropolis, from New York. And he writes a wonderful account of going to see the painting, which Snare manages to smuggle into absolutely everywhere. You know, he's always showing it somewhere in this building. You know? And he goes and describes the painting, which he found tremendous. And I have a great faith in Mark Twain. He's a linchpin for me in the views I have about what this picture might have been. And he also writes about Snare. He's the first person I have come across who actually produces a marvellous portrait of Snare, who is at this stage, I think, clearly going mad.
We've already said that we're not going to give away the final revelations of the book that happen after Snare is long dead, basically. But let's finish off talking about the end of Snare. So he's gone to New York. He's left, you know, he's left his life in Reading. He's left his wife and four children. He never comes back, never sees her again. How does he end up?
Well, he ends up doing quite well for a while, and then the Civil War comes and he just about manages to eke his living through that, and then he gets a job eventually being a bookseller's runner, in a way, is what he is. And there's a little account in the New York Times of somebody who remembered him when they were all trying to find him, some years after he probably had died, of this man, wearing a heavy plaid and a top hat, running Grand Central Station to Broadway and back, taking books back and forth between Scribner and Son, who have published this book very kindly in New York, and the booksellers on the streets and so on. And then I think he gets old and he just about kind of keeps surviving. And then late in life, when I think he's in his 70s, a man who is writing the first account of Spanish art in America asks if he can come and see him and visit the painting and so on, and he won't let him come. And I think at that point he feels that nobody values his painting properly, and he's become, I think, quite crazed a bit and defensive and so on, and he won't let anybody see it anymore, and he says it's caused too much pain to him, and he just fades away. And since the book was published, I thought he was a John Doe. I mean, I just thought he'd ended up somewhere, and I don't know where he'd ended up. But since the book was published, I've managed, through that amazing Mormon database, I found where his remains are, and he's in a cemetery in Brooklyn. Fashionable now, but obviously not then. And he certainly dies of neglect. The death certificate says that he dies of neglect and old age and carried off by pneumonia in the worst winter that Manhattan had seen in that century, alone in the top of a floor 7 of a sort of cold water tenement on Broadway.
And just very, very quickly to finish off, the paperback, which is out this week as we're recording this at the beginning of January, has a little afterword wherein after the book has been published, you've been able to see a cache of papers, basically, of letters, of Snare's. So what more does that sort of add to your idea of his character, being able to see the actual letters of his?
What an excellent question. I got letters from people who thought they had the picture. So, and I used to kind of get to the point where I would dread them coming, you know, I'd open them and they would say, well, and I think, oh no, you know, because in a way, I don't know whether people listening to this podcast would understand it. That painting, and there are two paintings in this story, so that's my biggest hint to you about what's really going on in the book. That painting disappears, and some people have written to me saying that they've got it or so on, and none of the candidates fit the bill at all. And I have really looked hard. But then I received a letter from a man who said he thought I might be interested in something he had and would I like to come to his house in Putney. And I was about to think, oh, no, no way am I going to... when I read who the letter was from, and it was from a man called Charles Sebag Montefiore, who is of the Sebag Montefiores, who is an antiquary himself and a director of the National Gallery. And he is a collector of primary sources that relate to the history of British collectors. People from all around the world go to this house in Putney, including all the scholars at the National Gallery and so on. And so I went, and I didn't really know what it was I was going to see, but this sitting on this table was a beautiful artefact. It's a book handmade by John Snare with an exquisite watercolour cover and some little drawings inside it. He was a considerable draftsman himself, which alone... Well, it's clearly very poignant to me because I knew that at the end of his life he would have liked to have been an artist. So I found a certificate of his attempts at night school to learn engraving. In fact, he gets a distinction. And this is his letter book, and it's in his hand. I thought to begin with it probably wasn't his hand. You know, maybe he had some kind of clerk copy out all these letters. Letters to people, letters from him, etc. And they're all about the painting. And the thing that this book tells me very clearly is that he was on the straight and narrow. He really was. Because at certain times in the whole of this story, I wondered if he was kind of duping everybody and, you know, if he was a complete con man and, you know, he's showing it in old Bond Street, you have to pay a shilling to see it, you know, I mean, maybe it's a fraud, you know, could it be real, could it be, and so on. And of course, the credibility of the painting somewhat depended for me on the credibility of John Snare. So was he really truthful? Was he sincere? And the book so abundantly shows the sincerity of the man and his deep researches and his endless attempts to get to the heart of the matter. And even he at times doubts the painting and, you know, so all of that. And then I suppose it proves one thing which I had wondered all along, which was the state of his mind as all of these shocks and bankruptcies and departures. And so what was the state of his mind? And I think that the handwriting in the book, if we can say that handwriting in any way expresses our state of mind, it certainly starts with a beautiful kind of Victorian probity, you know, the proper, you know, copper plate upright, marvellous, meticulous, very elegant hand, very educated looking, given that he was uneducated, as he describes himself. And then towards the end of the book, it is really beginning to disintegrate, and I think you can see his desperation causing a collapse. So it moved me very much, and what it did for me is to prove, I think, that some of the surmises I had weren't so wide of the mark.
I've been talking to Laura Cumming. We've been talking about her book, The Vanishing Man, In Pursuit of Velázquez, which is just out now in paperback from Vintage Books. Laura, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about it.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.